Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name's James Henderson, and I'm Director of the Gas Programme at OIES. Today, I'm joined by Martin Lambert, a Senior Research Fellow, to discuss his latest comment on the EU hydrogen strategy, which has just been published. Martin, welcome to the podcast. Good to have you with us.
Jim, hello. It's great to be here. Thanks.
Great. Okay, well, look, before we dig into the topic, I wonder if we could just start with some definitions of hydrogen for us amateurs. Could you talk us through the various colours that are used and what they mean?
Yeah, sure. It's probably worth saying, actually, that the EU strategy document deliberately does not use the colours, but they are used in common parlance. So grey is fossil-derived hydrogen, and that's what's produced today, typically by reforming natural gas. But that emits about 10 grams of CO2 for every gram of hydrogen. But then blue hydrogen is light grey, so the EU call it fossil-derived with carbon capture and storage, because the carbon capture then avoids most, but not all, of the CO2 going into the atmosphere. And then finally, green hydrogen is produced by electrolysis of water, so using renewable electricity and then splitting the water into component parts of hydrogen and oxygen. So that's the three colours.
Okay, great, thanks. And I think we're going to talk mainly about blue and green today. So anyway, but before we get sort of into that, I think it'd be useful to divide up the discussion along the value chain, as indeed they do on the in the strategy. So let's start with hydrogen production. In your comment, you note that the EU's main priority and ultimate goal is the production of green hydrogen, so that's hydrogen from electrolysis, but that its targets for 2024 and 2030 are rather ambitious. Could you just elucidate on that a bit?
Yeah, so green hydrogen kind of makes sense as the end goal, because when it's made from renewable electricity, it's effectively zero emissions, and so environmentalists and policymakers really like it. The 2024 target I actually rather like. So there's a goal of 6 gigawatts of green hydrogen by 2024. And for me, I like it because it contrasts with previous targets where there were sort of vague ambitions of, oh, we'll be in this huge quantity of hydrogen by 2050, but no indication at all of how to get there. So having something 6 gigawatts by 2024 is hugely challenging. When you think that the largest electrolyzer currently being built is 10 megawatts. So that target is 600 times that largest project today.
And just before we go on, could we, a little bit of context, 6 gigawatts of green hydrogen is equivalent to what in terms of current gas demand?
So rule of thumb was bearing in mind 2.5 gigawatts is about 1 BCM of gas demand. So 6 gigawatts, if my math is right, is about 2.5 BCM of gas demand. So it's hugely ambitious in terms of current hydrogen production, but in terms of the natural gas market, it's actually fairly small.
Indeed. Okay, well, I just wanted to get some context there. Now, just coming back to the electrolyzer point you made, and the size of electrolyzers today versus, you know, what they need to achieve by 2024, you know, the pace of change obviously needs to be dramatic. So, you know, is there any hope that that can be achieved?
It really depends on, I guess, government action. But because if you look at all projects in Europe today, if you add them all up, you get to something a bit under 5 gigawatts of projects, which claim they could possibly be on stream by 2030. So many of those projects will fall by the wayside. So 6 gigawatts is clearly hugely challenging. And so we need to see something like 20 gigawatts of projects being mentioned, coming online, or being developed in the next 12 to 18 months. And so it could be done, but it does require very immediate action in the next 12 to 18 months.
And just to follow up on the 10 megawatt project, you know, size today, are we talking about that 10 megawatts being expanded, or are we talking about lots of 10 megawatt projects being put together? How would it work?
Effectively, it seems to be a lot of, I'm not a technical expert on what would happen with electrolyzers, but my understanding is it's lots of medium-sized electrolyzers being put together. So there's a sort of scale up, 10 megawatts today, 100 megawatts have been talked about, some projects been around for a year or two with 100 megawatt scale, and then to get to gigawatt scale, you'd have many, many electrolyzers, either in series or parallel.
Okay, that's fine. So given that it's a really challenging target, that would seem to leave a path for blue hydrogen, at least in the medium term. And of course, that was a topic that was raised by Ralph Dickel in his recent paper on Germany. So would you say that the EU has softened its stance on blue hydrogen and that it now sees it as part of its decarbonisation strategy?
Possibly to some extent, I think, because, as I said before, the policymaker target is clearly all for green hydrogen. And in the German hydrogen strategy, which came out a couple of months ago, that was very focused on green hydrogen only. And they said, oh, well, maybe we'll import a bit of fossil-derived hydrogen in medium term. But the EU one at least does contemplate there could be some fossil-derived hydrogen with CCS, so blue hydrogen, in the short and medium term. And it talks about processes that could enable that to happen.
Okay, so, I mean, given that blue hydrogen then may have a role, how realistic do you think those hydrogen targets are by 2030? What do you think are the realistic levels by 2030, in fact, and how do those compare with the goals?
Yeah, well, just to remind our listeners, the target for 2024 was 6 gigawatts. For 2030, it's 40 gigawatts. Which sounds really quite ambitious. But sitting in 2020, I wouldn't say it's not possible. So ambitious, but not impossible. If you think what happened in the scaling up wind power and the solar power over the 10 years from, say, 2005 to 2015, then it's the same sort of speed of scale up could happen for green hydrogen. Then 40 gigawatts by 2030 could be doable. But things do need to start moving extremely fast right now. And it will need a lot of government incentives to make it happen.
Okay, well, we'll come to the incentives in a second. I guess one last question on the upstream. The hydrogen has kind of appeared as a topic of huge interest in about the last 12 months. And this strategy is the culmination of that in Europe. Do you see companies actually taking action yet to mean that target could be achieved, or is it still very much in the theoretical realms at the moment?
I think that's the encouragement, is you can now see some real projects sponsored by real companies which are in the pipeline. So particularly on blue hydrogen, there's several projects around in Norway, Netherlands, UK, but also now some gigawatt scale green hydrogen projects are also being talked about and being backed by big industrial players. So the one that springs to mind in the Netherlands, Shell and Gasunie are talking about a up to 4 to 5 gigawatt scale green hydrogen project. And so a few more of those, and then the 40 gigawatt target by 2030 starts to look a bit more realistic.
Okay, great. Well, I mean, obviously supply is one side of the equation. I mean, if you produce the stuff, you've actually got to then use it. So let's turn to the demand side now. And reading your comment, the key area for demand in the short term is industrial use, if I understand it correctly. Could you talk a little bit about where hydrogen is already used in this sector and where consumption can expand?
Yes. So hydrogen today is used almost exclusively in industry. And as I said before, it's mainly grey hydrogen, so quite polluting. But industries, so typically oil refining, petrochemicals, making ammonia, those are really the big users of hydrogen today. And clearly that's the first target for decarbonising hydrogen production, because you've got ready demand for the product and is emitting CO2. So if you can supply that demand without the CO2, that would be great. The next big target after that is probably other industry uses. And the leading one there is steel production, because steel production globally emits about 10% of total global carbon dioxide, so a huge emitter of CO2. And that could be converted to hydrogen using the so-called DRI, direct reduced iron process, and that could use decarbonized hydrogen, and so it could reduce the CO2 emissions from steel production hugely.
And if I'm not mistaken, there are already some projects, I think, in Germany, which are starting to do that. Is that right?
In Germany and in Sweden and Japan, there are various projects around looking at decarbonizing steel. They're all quite long term, but they're moving in the right direction.
Okay. The EU also mentions the transport sector, but if I read correctly, you seem a little skeptical of some of the areas that are mentioned are already covered or, you know, look like they're going to be covered by electric vehicles. So could you expand on your views a little there? And do you think that actually the role of hydrogen cells in cars is a realistic one?
Yeah, I mean, there is in general a bit of hype around hydrogen. So I think in summary, hydrogen will have a role in the energy transition, but there are a bit ambitious claims in some areas. And road transport is perhaps one of those. Hydrogen fuel cell cars have been around quite a long time. I mean, it's like anecdote. I worked for Shell back in 2008 in the alternative energies business, and one of my colleagues was busy closing down a number of hydrogen stations in California because there just weren't enough cars to use it. That was a previous wave of hydrogen. And then today, there's under 20,000 fuel cell vehicles globally, and compare that with 7 million or more battery electric vehicles. And so essentially, where the customer can cope with the limited range and the longer refueling time for a battery electric vehicle, the efficiency of that really wins. So where batteries can do the job, they will do the job. But if you really, really need long range or rapid fueling time, then hydrogen can have a role. So somewhere in road transport, but a bit of a niche. And then longer term for transport, maybe marine and aviation, there could be a role for hydrogen to make synthetic fuels there too. But that's pretty early stage R&D at the moment.
And presumably we've still got the same problem as we have, well, we had at least with electric stations, which is, can you actually find a filling station with hydrogen in it?
Well, I think that actually is in favour of electric vehicles, because at least with electric vehicles, you can always charge it at home, plug it in, but no one's got a hydrogen tap in their house. And so for a hydrogen, you really definitely need a brand new network, whereas for electric charging, you've got far more flexibility of options.
Okay, yeah. All right, so then let's move to the power sector, where there seems to be a role for hydrogen in storage as a backup for renewable energy. In the comment, you note that the EU focuses on short to medium term storage, which I think that you believe that the advantage of hydrogen is really for the longer term. Could you just talk about that a bit?
So in the strategy, it talks about hydrogen having a role for daily and longer term balancing of electricity. I think I'd argue, again, with my battery argument, that for daily balancing, then batteries, so grid scale batteries, can do the job and provide that short term balancing. And they've got that better round trip efficiency. But for longer term storage, so think of like a week or a month when it's not very windy or the sun's not shining, then batteries simply can't store enough energy in order to do the job. And so storing hydrogen in underground storage, like underground salt caverns, is a better way to store the energy required. And that can then be drawn out of storage over that week or month when it's not windy or not sunny. And then that produces the electricity. So short-term batteries, long-term hydrogen, that feels like a way to go.
And just to be clear on this, and I guess this means that every single wind farm or solar farm has an electrolyzer associated with it, and that, you know, when the electricity is not being used by the grid, it just goes into the electrolyzer and you make hydrogen, store it, and bring it back when you need it.
Well, there's kind of two different models. So you don't need to necessarily directly link the renewable power generation with hydrogen, but you can do. And indeed, there are plans in some cases to build some wind turbines which have hydrogen as the output. So basically an integrated wind turbine and electrolyzer, and the output of that is then hydrogen, which then goes into storage or into the grid and is then used later.
Okay, great. I mean, you know, I've mentioned grids, obviously, in electricity sense, which brings me on to infrastructure in terms of hydrogen. And I guess the other key question we haven't touched on yet is networks. The strategy mentions a gradual development of hydrogen infrastructure based on initial clusters. But could you tell us a bit more about the plans for the infrastructure?
So on the cluster thing, the idea is that you have industrial development. So I talked about how the first renewable hydrogen could be used for converting existing industry and maybe steel manufacturing. And then you could expand from that into clusters. Or the strategy document uses the term values. I'm not quite sure why values, but that's a sort of expanded cluster, I think, around the industrial centres. It's also worth mentioning the idea of a hydrogen backbone. So a week after the strategy report, there was a report came out from a European network operators about converting much of the current gas grid to be a parallel hydrogen grid, which would then link these clusters and valleys together. Much of that could be repurposed natural gas pipelines as well, which then would lower the cost of building that hydrogen backbone. But I think clusters first, and then expanding to bigger clusters, valleys, and maybe a bigger network later.
And is there any conflict there? I mean, I was under the impression that there were some people who were advocating for a kind of an immediate move to the hydrogen backbone strategy, and you know, having, I think in some countries, perhaps the Netherlands, there's talk of parallel networks in a rather short order. Is there a conflict? Is there a debate between sort of the cluster route and the backbone route, or are they complementary?
I think it's a timing question, really. So I think the EU strategy document seemed to support the idea that clusters are where you go initially, and then over time the clusters expand, and then the backbone type network then develops. And that seems to be sensible. Building a network up front doesn't seem to be required. So I'm not sure that's... I think clusters first and then the network is really the way to go.
Okay.
While on networks, one thing just worth mentioning is about blending, because there has been some talk of blending, say, up to 20% hydrogen in gas grids. But actually, I think the strategy recognises that's not really a way to decarbonise. It may help very initially. It is a disposal route for some early hydrogen production, but it's not really a pathway to decarbonisation and the long-term goal of getting to net zero.
Okay, and while we're mentioning, you know, moving on from blending, the existing network, could it take hydrogen? I mean, could it be converted? I mean, I understand the pipes, most pipes could be, but it's the kind of compressors and things which are the issue, or is that not right?
It seems to be something that still needs a bit further research, but the general understanding appears to be that most gas pipes, even if they're made of metal, then with the right inspection regime, then they probably can carry hydrogen. There is a risk that hydrogen being a smaller molecule makes the metal get brittle and could then potentially crack. So it needs more regular inspection for doing that. But also, as you say, the gas system is quite complex. So compressors, seals, metering, much of that would have to change to carry hydrogen. So it can be done, but needs some effort to make it happen.
Okay, fine. So finally, let's talk about how this is all going to get financed. Obviously, that's critical. You mentioned the need for government support, but how does the EU strategy envisage this being provided?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the strategy is a bit sketchy on details. So it sets the ambition, but not yet how it will actually be financed. I think rather than being financed by central governments, it appears to be that it should be private sector investment. And so it's about putting a framework in place to attract that private sector investment. Because as an order of magnitude, if you look at the additional renewable power generation required and the electrolyzers and other infrastructure, we're talking order of magnitude 500 billion euros of costs, I think, to get to the target by 2030. And continuing that rate for the decades thereafter. So this is a huge investment and needs to attract private funding.
I guess there's a question about whether one does this through kind of subsidy or one tries to use market-related tools, which obviously we have a liberalised market at the moment, a competitive market. And you mentioned both expansion of the ETS, the emissions trading scheme, and also carbon contracts for differences, which would seem to help, you know, blue hydrogen in the next few years. What do you think about that?
I think that's right. I mean, I think for green hydrogen, it seems clear that it will require some direct subsidies, probably awarded by auction. So a government would say, we want to have 3 gigawatts of green hydrogen, and we have an auction of how much, what price you need to do that. But you're right. In the strategy, one thing it does mention explicitly is this concept of carbon contracts for differences. So contract for differences has been used in the power generation industry for quite a while. The idea is that the government guarantees a price, which will pay the difference between the market price and the price required by the project. And so the carbon thing will be the same with the ETS. And so you have an auction where the government say, we want an auction, what price do you require for a carbon price to make your project go ahead? And with the price structure today, if you did that, then blue hydrogen, so methane reforming with CCS, would certainly win because it's lower cost than green hydrogen. And so I think that's actually a fairly clear way that the strategy could be supporting the blue hydrogen initially.
And that's presumably getting quite a lot of support from the gas industry, the existing gas industry itself. I mean, that's an obvious way to transition away from methane.
Well, yes, but it's early days yet, I think, and it requires the member state governments to put in place the actual frameworks. And no one's really come up yet with a carbon contract for difference auction. But hopefully, as I say, if we're going to move as fast as the strategy contemplates, then the next 12 to 18 months should see some of those auctions taking place.
I guess that leads me to the concluding question, which is, you know, what are your overall conclusions about the strategy, and what are the key next steps as you see them?
Well, I think it's a very exciting step forward. So I think it's a key document, which is why it was worthy of writing a comment about it. And I think the next steps really is for individual member states to start to have some of these auctions, either for carbon contract for differences or for support schemes for green hydrogen, in order to work with industry. So industry need to develop the projects, and then the governments and regulators need to have a framework to enable a business case for those investments to go ahead. And that, so I think what we hope to see over the next few 12 or 18 months, say, is those sort of auctions and those sort of projects really moving forward and getting to an investment decision within the next 2 years or so.
So we kind of need to see some action relatively soon if these targets have any chance of being met. And, you know, the targets, as you've already elucidated, are realistic but tough.
Well, 2024 is really very close, isn't it? And so with a two-year construction time, say, the investment decision needs to happen by 2022. And so all the planning and everything else to take place between now and then. So there's really not much time to lose if that's going to be a realistic ambition.
And, you know, is the EU strategy going to act as a blueprint for individual countries? I mean, we've already seen a German hydrogen strategy. I'd be interested to know what else is going on in Europe in terms of individual countries. But actually, what about the rest of the world? Are they looking at the EU and thinking, actually, this is a good plan, or are they already ahead?
Well, take Europe first. So around Europe, so the strategy is already, as you say, for Germany. So Portugal, Netherlands, Norway have all produced strategies so far. But I think the EU document provides a framework for other countries within Europe. But then looking outside Europe, Japan, Korea, Australia, they've already developed their own hydrogen strategies. Each one's actually a bit different. It kind of reflects the different circumstances in each country. So Australia is quite focused on large-scale export using their abundant wind and solar resource, whereas Japan, by contrast, is looking at how they can import hydrogen from various places, and so focused on how to lower the cost of transporting hydrogen. So I'm not sure the EU runs a blueprint, but it's interesting to see there is a lot of hydrogen interest now around the world.
And I guess actually just one question that occurs to me is, you know, you mentioned imports there. There is some thought that, you know, part of the European strategy would be to do with importing hydrogen from neighbouring countries. What do you think about that? I mean, Russia, North Africa, are there plans afoot for these countries to produce hydrogen and export it to the EU?
Well, one thing we need to mention about it, so part of the strategy is 40 gigawatts within Europe and another 40 gigawatts imported from just to the east of Europe, say Ukraine, or to the south of Europe from North Africa. And so there aren't any concrete plans I'm aware of yet in those countries. But there are certainly some ideas being developed of how you could, for example, have abundant solar power in North Africa, and then you could ship hydrogen across the Mediterranean by a pipeline, maybe a repurposed natural gas pipeline. So lots of evolving ideas there still to come.
Excellent. And just finally, I guess a bit of marketing, what are the OIES plans for covering hydrogen over the next 12 months and beyond?
Well, I talk quite a lot in this podcast about sort of monitoring projects and seeing what's happening. We did a report last year with Imperial College looking at a database of projects happening in Europe. We're looking to keep that up to date as the plans develop within Europe. We're also looking to expand it more internationally and collaborating with some other organisations globally to really build a global picture of what's happening in scaling up renewable gas. The whole regulatory question I talked about as well. So how do these carbon contract differences or other incentives work? And our colleagues Alex Barnes and Katia Efimova will be looking at regulation in more detail over the coming months as well. And finally, we're looking in more detail at the approach in different countries around Europe. So how does this EU strategy play out and what different countries are doing? So there's plenty to do. I think he was busy for the next 12 months or so.
Indeed, it's certainly become a very hot topic over the last few months. So, yeah, plenty to get on with. Okay, great. Martin, thanks very much. We've reached the end of our time now. That's perfect. So thanks to you for a fascinating discussion, which I hope that you listeners have found both informative and interesting. You can find Martin's comment on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. where you can also find our full podcast series, as well as all our other output. If you'd like further information about the Institute, then you can also find our details on the website there as well. With all that said, it just remains me to wish you good health to all of you and your families, to thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website, at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.